from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Early voting began yesterday in San Francisco, and voters had their work cut out for them in selecting from the crowded field of 16 candidates in the race for mayor. In the hour coming up, we discuss the candidates and the major issues and the often challenging for voters to fully understand ranked choice voting. Forum is next. We'll include your calls, emails, and online questions and comments after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum program. And in this opening forum hour, we want to turn our attention to the San Francisco mayoral campaign, which now has 16 candidates. Voting began yesterday, debates have taken place, and ranked choice voting has the potential, as it did in Oakland, of creating an unexpected or at least surprise outcome. And we're going to talk about all that. And we have a couple of our experts here, Corey Cook and Rachel Gordon. But first, Julia McAvoy is here with us in studio, senior editor for KQED News, and they have put together really an exceptional kind of vox populi. Welcome, Julia.
Thanks for having me.
This is a series that's been running now, and essentially you went out to different districts and talked to the folks.
Yes, we did. We really wanted to get out into the neighborhoods and find out what people wanted from their next mayor, what they wanted to make the city a more livable place. And we heard, you know, some general stuff that we all sort of are familiar with, transportation, crime, schools, budget issues, jobs. But then we kind of tried to go a little more granular into specific communities and find out what was unique to various places in the city.
Well, let's hear some of what you heard. And let's begin with a gentleman who is in the Mission District. This is a fellow by the name of Salvatore Crespo. Tell us a little bit about him.
Well, Salvatore is both a painter and a decorator, and he echoed a lot of, you know, we're all familiar with gentrification in the Mission. This is nothing new to us. But in the last 10 years, since the last census, a quarter of the Latino population has declined in the Mission. And so there's this fear of another wave taking place right now. I don't know if you guys have been familiar with these bidding wars that are going on once again, where you've got an apartment available and then people are sort of overbidding and the rents are spiking. And this is causing sort of a fear on the part of those who are trying to hang on that, you know, yet again, they may go under. So Crespo's kind of referring to sort of the what the impact of that is on the feeling of the neighborhood itself.
Let's hear his voice.
Most of the people, they can't really stay here anymore longer. And then there's other people, they can afford it. They have more, you know, money. But at the same time, that appeal that from the city that was so homey, now it's becoming more like a trendy neighborhood that, you see, is not the same.
This is essentially the chief concern of this resident of the Mission when you asked him, what do you want from a mayor, really?
Yeah. I mean, affordable housing really is a citywide issue, but I think it's particularly acute in the Mission.
Well, what did you find out? Let's go to another neighborhood in the Panhandle Park area. Found out something quite different in terms of residents there.
Yeah. Reporter Kelly Wilkinson kind of tried to cross District 5, you know, NOPA, Western Addition, the Haight. And what she kept hearing was parents sort of bubbling. That was what rose up for her, was this feeling that parents really, and you heard it in the debate, the mayoral debate last week. You guys have talked about, you know, on your show, families fleeing the city. So what can the next mayor do to make this a more family-friendly place? And, you know, there's big issues like the affordability of multi-unit, you know, dwellings and schools. But then there's little stuff that they really think that the next mayor can take on. And she specifically talks about cleaning up the parks.
We use the Panhandle Park tons, and they've done a little bit to help turn it around. But, for example, that playground, which is our primary playground, is pretty atrocious, and it definitely needs love. And I think increased police presence to the degree that it would help get some of the drug element off the street. We see that a lot in our neighborhood, especially since we're right off the Panhandle. And there are definitely points in time where you're concerned about the safety of your kids and who's coming up and down your street.
And that's Ann Houck, who you spoke to in the Panhandle. And let's go to the Marina now. We've got a fellow by the name of John Lieberman whom you spoke to in the Marina. What did he say?
Yeah. Yeah, in the Marina Pack Heights, Cow Hollow, what we found is that people just really love where they are. It's a great place. There's not a lot wrong with it, and they don't want anybody to mess it up. So their call is, you know, don't ram development down our throats. And in this particular, you know, there's been a proposal for a transitional home for foster youth there that they're not too happy about. Other things that they have successfully fought off through the years. But in this case, Mr. Lieberman, who's in the Marina, is concerned about a proposal to extend trolleys into Fort Mason.
Looks like that's going to be pushed through without a lot of discussion from what I've heard so far. So I hope there's a lot of discussion about that, as it will bring a lot of people into the area. And we already have, after events and everything, a lot of trash and beer bottles and drunkenness already, because this is an area for a lot of young people.
We're talking with Julia McAvoy here in studio, senior editor of KQED News, hearing some of the cuts from going out and finding out what people want in the next mayor of San Francisco or what is of primary concern to them. And you went to the Bayview, too.
Yes. Joshua Johnson had been actually reporting in the Bayview for some time, and we decided to go to the Bayview because we were really trying to get a full sort of range of what people in the city have to say. We wanted a lot of different voices. What he found there was sort of this real sense of isolation, that a lot of wealth has flowed in and out of the city over the decades, and that very little of it has stuck in the Bayview Hunters Point area. So the big issue on people's minds right there continues to be just jobs.
They bring people from the community that do like to work, that do want to work, to let us work. Don't go off because a few bad seeds, you know what I'm saying, might have got a job and then got a first paycheck and left. People, like some of us, like us, I'm 39 years old, we got kids. You know what I'm saying? I like to work. I got a nice resume and everything, but I'm from the neighborhood. I can't get a job.
That's a gentleman with the name of Mark Anthony, in fact.
Yes, he said he was without his Cleopatra when we did meet him out there.
Or without his Jennifer Lopez.
That was the reporter's comeback, actually.
Well, a good series and an important series, and thank you so much, Julia, for bringing it to our attention.
Well, I appreciate being on, and just wanted to mention the great job that our Public Insight folks did in terms of putting all this onto an interactive map online where you can actually go test your assumptions about what you think of these neighborhoods, what you thought you knew about those neighborhoods, and compare people across the city by referencing their quotes on a map. It's kind of fun.
And you can go to kqednews.org and really hear the whole series. Thank you, Julia. We have with us Corey Cook and Rachel Gordon. Corey Cook's assistant professor of politics and directs the Leo McCarthy Center for Public Service and the Common Good at USF. Good morning, Corey.
Thank you.
Good to be Rachel here. Gordon here with us, City Hall reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle. Good morning, Rachel.
Good morning, Michael.
Glad to have you both. And let's talk about the mayor's race. First of all, it's been described as one of the most unexciting races that we've seen in a long time. Don't seem to be many sparks or a lot of electricity, Corey. But you've said it's kind of bland when you look at it as a sort of whole, but it's more exciting when you take the individuals.
Yeah, I think there's some real characters in the race, and I think, you know, there's some real talent in the race. So I've actually been pretty impressed by the field. The challenge is, you know, you see them all en masse, and so as, you know, either 16 of them or the sort of more 11 sort of more serious ones, and you view them all together, it's, you know, San Francisco is a pretty liberal democratic place, and as a result, these candidates are sort of shades off of each other on a series of issues. And so when you watch them, I think, you know, the issues that were raised about, you know, jobs or fiscal matters or Muni, I think most of the candidates just sort of agree to a point. And so taken together, there's not the spark of the Newsom-Gonzalez race or the Willie Brown-Tom Amiana race. It's just sort of 12, you know, 11 shades that are just sort of slightly different than one another.
Yeah, in fact, I moderated a debate. It wasn't really even a debate. It was at Yerba Buena Center about different candidates and how they come down on the arts and support of the arts. And everybody was just so friendly and positive, and we all love the arts and all that. And Rachel, maybe part of this is because of ranked choice. I mean, a fear of offending, at least until Ed Lee got into the race.
Well, it could be a fear of offending. I think there's also one thing that we have with ranked choice voting is we don't have a runoff primary. And that's something we've had in past mayor's races where it was the two leading candidates would come and duke it out really over the last month 6 weeks of the campaign, and you could really differentiate, drill down on what the differences were. I mean, just as we heard with at the top of the hour with what people were talking about, jobs, development, safety, you're not going to find a candidate that says, I'm anti-jobs. You're not going to find a candidate that says, I don't want my streets to be safe. There might be some differences on development there. It's very hard when you have that large of a field to go, okay, you want to create affordable housing. How are you going to pay for it? Where are you going to put it? When people have one-minute sound bites, it's difficult to get that kind of answer out from them. They all have their websites where they do have much more detailed analysis of what they plan to do, but it has been hard to detail it. And that's what you get when you have this system of no primary runoff. You really don't – you have to – let's just say you have to really do your homework, work very hard to find the differences with the candidates.
Well, the big issues seem to be, Corey, jobs and really fiscal issues right at the top. Certainly, I remember when homelessness was at the top. I remember when the Muni was at the top. We've got kind of a different landscape of issues, don't we?
I think so. I mean, it's a different context than in past elections. And as a result, I think also, you know, fortuitously or skillfully, the mayor got some of those things off the agenda. So I think the deal that was negotiated on the budget, which was a largely consensus budget, meant that, you know, the candidates had all sort of locked themselves into positions where they weren't really taking much differences of opinion on budgetary matters. And so, yeah, I think, you know, the primary concerns people have relate to the nature of the economy and how, you know, how we balance our budgets. And as a result, I think, you know, to me, the top issues you'd expect, pension reform is off the table largely. And there's one candidate or maybe two who really disagree with the consensus measure. Budgetary matters is largely off the table from the debates. I mean, it's mostly, yes, I voted for that. Yes, I agreed with that. I would manage it slightly differently. But as a result, I think, you know, the primary concerns voters have don't really translate very well into this candidacy.
What about something like the Central Subway extension, Rachel Gordon?
I mean, that's kind of raised up as the big kind of lightning rod issue in this race, the Central Subway. Do you want to put rail service, light rail service into Chinatown? Dennis Herrera was the one who came out swinging against it. We have to remember that he was for the project before. Now he's saying he's taken a second look at the numbers and the design of it. He's having second thoughts. But you have to also look that this is one of Ed Lee's projects. This is something that he has long been for, that his supporters in Chinatown have long promoted as a big issue. The Board of Supervisors has signed off on it several times unanimously over the years, the Metropolitan Transport or Municipal Transportation Agency. But Herrera wanted to set himself apart from Lee, and this is the way he's going to do it. And when you ask that question, where do you stand on the Central Subway at debates, that's where you see them all want to chime in. It's not just Herrera who's against it, but Lee Lanier has voiced concerns about it. Michaela Alioto-Pierre has. Tony Hall has. Jeff Adachi has. And then you've got the other candidates, Lee, Phil Ting, David Chu, Bevin Dufty, John Avalos, who are saying, no, this is a good project. So we talk about it's Muni off the table, and it's not just about this rail extension and capital money going into it, but how might it affect the Muni system as a whole. So that was kind of a surprising one for me. It's a sleeper issue that kind of emerged so far in this race.
But as far as the race itself, at this point, from your perspective, it's Ed Lee's to lose?
I think it absolutely is his to lose. The polls are showing that he's anywhere between 30% and 40% in the first round of voting. That's where he'll come out. I guess the question is who's going to get the second or third place votes. So for his to lose, if he did nothing, he'd probably do okay right now. If he does something or doesn't stumble, that's what people are looking for. I've talked to numerous candidates over the last few weeks going, do you really believe you have a chance to win? And they all kind of hedge and they go, I see a path to victory. Well, what's that path to victory? And it's not that they're going to do something so amazing, so stellar that voters are going to go, I need this person to lead us at City Hall. But they go, what Ed Lee has to really do is stumble. He has to have the worst fumble you could see, and then maybe one of us can get in and take over in that lead status.
Well, a lot of votes for David Chu could put him in second place, couldn't it, Corey?
Conceivably, the question is, you know, how many of these votes get counted? I mean, one of the things that happened in Oakland, it was so unique about Oakland, was that 80% of voters used all three choices in ranked choice voting. In San Francisco, usually more than half of the voters only rank one candidate, and so the second place votes never in San Francisco have never really mattered much until the last election, when there were two board races that were pretty interesting. But by and large, a field like this in San Francisco, the front runner actually, you know, builds their lead in subsequent rounds of tabulation. So they actually typically front runners do very well with ranked choice voting in San Francisco. So, you know, the question is can he stumble badly enough that he becomes polarizing in the way that Don Prado was polarizing in Oakland? And if not, I mean, again, the record of ranked choice voting is, you know, the front runner just is very much advantaged by the system.
Well, there was also, Rachel, go ahead.
No, we've seen some interesting turns of event, I think, on the campaign trail. When Ed Lee first changed his mind and said, actually, I've decided I am going to run for mayor, you saw several candidates come out hard against him. David Chu, Dennis Herrera, who else? Leland Yee did. Came out, you know, this guy said he wasn't going to run. Now he's running. Now you're seeing people kind of change their positions a little bit. David Chu, who was very angry at first, came out very forcefully, now has backed off. It's Herrera who's kind of kept the drumbeat going. But it's funny to see.
Doesn't seem to have ignited, though, really, does it?
No, it hasn't. But it's interesting to watch Bevin Dufty, who's Mr. Nice Guy on the campaign trail. He's the ex-supervisor who's been running now for, I think, 2 years. He has new ads out. Ed Lee's campaign motto is he gets it done. And Bevin Dufty's his kind of the thing he's ending his commercials with, something like, if I get it done, at least I'm going to get it done better. It's kind of that message that's out there. It's a little dig that he's taking at the mayor. So I think there's still some hope that maybe you can still get him on the issue of changing his mind.
Your newspaper has endorsed David Chu.
We have. The endorsement came out late yesterday afternoon. I think it took a lot of people by surprise. But Chu, I sat in on the editorial board meeting where he came in. He did extremely well. The Chronicle, some people might say it's kind of the downtown corporate interest button-down newspaper, I think took a pretty bold chance of not going with the person you might have thought would have gotten the endorsement. It seems that the Chronicle, and Corey would know better than I on this, but the Chronicle and Bay Guardian, went for John Avalos, are the newspapers whose endorsements really make a difference still in campaigns.
We've got a whole continuum here. You got John Avalos over on the left and then Tony Hall over on the right. I mean, you got quite a wide choice. With Lee as the front runner, though, Corey, I'm just wondering. They've been trying to go after him with his ties to Willie Brown and Rose Pack, and that doesn't seem to have stuck really either.
No, I think there are a couple of problems with that. One is that people like Willie Brown, and so it turns out he polls very well as a very popular former mayor, and so the ties to Brown aren't hurting him, and nobody really knows who Rose Pack is. And so, you know, it's something that generically voters, I just don't think is really connecting very well with voters. That as Rachel said, the challenge is can he come close enough back to the pack that one of them can win, but the field doesn't like each other very well either. So it's not the case in Oakland where they actually said, you know, anybody but Don Prada, and literally anybody but Don Prada we prefer. This field actually, some of them prefer, you know, the mayor to each other. And so they're not really likely to gang up on him because, you know, they initially, remember, there was a anybody but Leland Yee campaign that was being run by the other candidates. So they're watching each other's numbers as well as they're watching the mayor. So they're, you know, they're certainly hitting him. They realize to have a chance, he's got to come back to the field. On the other hand, they've got to be very careful that they don't elevate one of the candidates from the field that they're not fond of themselves. And so I think, you know, you don't have this sort of three against one phenomenon you have in Oakland. You have really a very broad field of people who have their own disagreements and have been running for a year against each other without the mayor in the field thinking, you know, we need to differentiate ourselves from each other. And maybe we gang up on Leland Yee. And in the process of this, the mayor jumped in and the election just completely changed. Its whole tone and tenor of the race just flipped overnight.
Well, let's see if we can differentiate the candidates. I mean, there's a sense in each of the candidates' minds, I think, wouldn't be too presumptuous to assume that they can win this one. Right, Rachel?
I don't think they'd be in it if they couldn't win it. There's one thing that is keeping some candidates, I believe, in this race, and that's public financing. This is the first time public financing has been used in a mayor's race to this extent. And what we're finding is that if they have accepted public financing and they drop out of the race, they have to pay the money back. So I think you've got some folks who know they have absolutely no chance to win, but they're staying in it. But I've asked that as a voter and not as a reporter, still trying to figure out myself who I'm going to vote for. And it's the question I ask, do you really want to be mayor? Is it really in your belly to be mayor? Is that what you want to do? And you can talk to a few candidates and they go, yeah, I want this more than anything. And they are running hard and they're running to win.
Who's got the fire in the belly from your reporting, from your inquiries?
I'm just going to say at this point a number, and that's between me and my God with that question I ask. It's my voter thing. But, you know, Dennis Herrera is running very hard for mayor. He is hungry to be mayor. He's decided he's going to try to be mayor by going on the attack, and he's done that relentlessly, really, over the last, since Ed Lee got into the race. Bevin Dufty has an interesting tack that he's taking to be mayor. He's not saying, vote for me number one, I mean, although he said he'd like that, but he's going, consider me as your number two or your number three choice. And you're starting to hear that a little more from candidates. John Avalos is a true believer. He really is a progressive torchbearer in San Francisco. And he's like, this is our opportunity to really set the tone of what kind of San Francisco we want to be. Terry Baum, the Green Party candidate, she doesn't have a chance to be mayor, but she is at every forum she can go to. Even if she's not invited, she will bring her own chair and set it on
the
stage.
She came and insisted on being the one the year before Wayne, and she got the most laughs and
right,
a good
she
deal
does.
Of
her
applause. She's a good performer.
Yeah. It's the economy, duh. I mean, that's her That's her line in this. But she wants to do it, too. So this is an opportunity. It's a stage to get your message out there, what your politics might be. And we can't forget Tony Hall. He's the ex-supervisor who represented the more conservative west of Twin Peaks neighborhoods in San Francisco, who is very serious about saying we're going in the wrong direction. You're talking about taxing. You're talking about new fees. We've got to rethink San Francisco. And then Jeff Adachi, who was the late entry in the race, came in. He's the public defender who came in on the last day that you could join the race. He's really been out there fighting hard, too. His big issue has been pensions.
Hitting with pensions, yeah.
That's been his baby. Let's do pension reform. And he's got his measure that goes beyond what the, quote, city family has had that Ed Lee and the Board of Supervisors put out there is how to reform the pension thing. But he's going beyond pension as well. He is looking at other issues of how you can make San Francisco a more livable city.
And what do you see, Corey Cook, as what ultimately differentiates these candidates or how they're setting up differentiation between themselves?
In terms of issues, I mean, I think the central subway is certainly one. I think pension reform, but it becomes this sort of one candidate versus most of the rest of the field. And so it doesn't, it's tough for voters. I think, you know, the challenge with ranked choice voting to me is that, you know, normal election, what we used to do in San Francisco, this two-stage runoff system, you'd have candidates who'd say, to get into a runoff, I need, you know, in this field, what, 12-15% gets you into a runoff? And so I'm going to, you know, find that 12-15% of the electorate and micro-target them and really speak to their issues and see if I can't get into the runoff, where your whole means of campaigning is to differentiate from the rest of the field and really target a small audience and then say, from there, as you do from a primary to a general, I'll then pivot and sort of focus citywide and see if I can take that message to the city. What you have here is, I think, frankly, information overload for voters. Candidates have a position on every issue, on everything. And so, you know, Dog Pack has endorsed, and every neighborhood association has endorsed, and every newspaper has endorsed, and they're all endorsing on these citywide issues. And so as a result, candidates in this stage of the election have wide-ranging positions on everything under the sun. And I think most voters look at that and say, yeah, you see these shades of disagreement. But taken as a whole, it's just a lot of information about an awful lot of candidates with long records. I mean, you have folks who've been elected officials for 20-plus years who have these long, you know, exhaustive records of public service, and candidates, you know, have positions just on everything. And so it's, I think, yeah, there are disagreements about things, but to me, they're just matters of degree. It's, you know, the debates are, I agree, but only slightly more. I agree, only slightly less. I mean, it's hard to really get a sense.
There's a real irony here in many ways when you think about the issues, and that is that many people, and it's come up time and time again on this program, are concerned about the schools, but the mayors have really little.
Yeah, just funding, a little bit of funding.
Yeah. I mean, well, aside from that, though, I mean, the mayors really have little say. Rachel, you're going to add?
Yeah, and I was going to say, what it's coming down to a lot, and there are plenty of opportunities at neighborhood forums, go to your neighborhood farmers market, everywhere. There's a good chance you're going to be able to see a candidate. A lot of it comes down to, what do you think of them when you see them? What kind of leader are they going to be? There's one kind of refreshing voice that came in, and that's Joanna Reese. She's never run for office before. She even had a problem of not voting for people running for office before. But she's come in, and she's run very hard, a venture capitalist. And her whole issue, really, or their big thing, has been about education, of improving the schools, of bringing in the private sector to help build partnerships with the public schools to keep kids and families in San Francisco. Michaela Alioto-Pierre, the former supervisor, has really hammered as well on the whole schools issue and making the city more family-friendly.
Let me put the phone number out there and invite those of you listening. Of course, you don't have to be a San Franciscan. What would you like in the next San Francisco mayor? And if you have questions about ranked choice voting, please feel free to bring them to the table here. There are many San Franciscans who still think Gavin Newsom is the mayor of San Francisco, so let's try to at least clear up some of the things that may be befuddling. Our toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786. You can join us now. What are you looking for in the next mayor of San Francisco? What would you like the next mayor of San Francisco to make priority? Again, toll-free, 866-733-6786, or send an email to forum@kqed.org, or post a question or comment on our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on this segment. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Early voting began yesterday in San Francisco, and voters have a lot of research to do in picking their mayor. There's a crowded field of 16 candidates running for the office, and we're reviewing major issues in the race, assessing the candidates, discussing the impact of ranked choice voting. We had Julia McAvoy with us, senior editor of KQED News, and we were able to hear some of the voices from different districts in San Francisco in terms of what they want in a mayor. And Rachel Gordon and Corey Cook are with us here in studio assessing what not only the candidates look like, but what differentiates them, and just the whole often enigmatic issue of ranked choice voting. You are welcome to join the program, particularly if you have something you would like to express about what you want in the next mayor or who you like in terms of the field. And it is a vast field, and it is, many have said, not the most electric and electrifying race that we have seen through the years, but it's nevertheless one that concerns the future of this hub city. Our toll-free number, again, 866-733-6786. Our email address, forum@kqed.org. Or you can join us by going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and clicking on the segment, or join us on our Facebook page. Corey Cook, again, is Assistant Professor of Politics and Director of the Leo McCarthy Center for Public Service and the Common Good at the University of San Francisco. Rachel Gordon is City Hall reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle. And here's a web comment from Chris, who says, at the time Ed Lee was named acting mayor, there was the issue of so many ostensibly qualified people planning to run for mayor, and the fact that whomever was the acting mayor would have a huge advantage in the coming election. Under these circumstances, Ed Lee made it plain he would not run for mayor if appointed acting mayor. This was not 5 or 10 years ago, but less than a year ago. Then he is appointed mayor and promptly changes his mind. Unacceptable, untrustworthy, and definitely undeserving of a vote. That's one listener, and there are others who feel that way, but it certainly hasn't caught fire, has it, Rachel?
No, it hasn't. There are some people I know personally who go, I'm not going to vote for him because he changed his mind. On the other hand, folks are saying, look, he got into office. He did change his mind. It's going to be our right as voters, as citizens of San Francisco, to decide whether we like the job he's doing. We want to keep him in office, or we say, no, you know, we don't want to do it. It's something that didn't really resonate. I think the agreement he made not to run for mayor was really an insider agreement with members of the Board of Supervisors. I don't think that the general populace really was paying much attention to that promise that was made, although they were interested in.
He said on this program, I'm not running. I want my job back as administrator. I don't want to be mayor.
He told everyone that. It did leave a bad taste in people's mouths. And then people go, well, maybe he's a politician like all the rest of the politicians, and you can't always believe everything they say.
That said, it played a key role, it seems, in the Chronicle endorsement. I thought they rather pointedly in the paper said not, you know, just that he'd gone back on his word, but they were worried that, you know, his relationship with the Board of Supervisors would be damaged because they couldn't trust him anymore. Again, I don't know if that's really resonating with voters, but it, certainly at a high level, you do see this conversation happening.
There's also been some talk, Corey, about campaign ethics in Ed Lee.
Yeah, I mean, he's, you know, there have been a whole series of questions about the campaign, about initially how, you know, the Draft Ed Lee movement and how it got its funding. I think, you know, this new book that's come out raises even more questions, frankly, about, you know, the Ed Lee Independent Committee came out with a book about Ed Lee, which, again, throws all those issues back into the public conversation about who's financing his campaign, who's behind it, is the Independent Committee really separate from his campaign, and all those questions. And I think, you know, to me, he's better served by sort of staying above the fray and, you know, not producing 100-and-some-odd page books about himself and that sort of stuff.
Well, we're going to go to your phone calls. Let me just read a couple of emails here. This is from Faye, who says, how can you not mention the drama that is David Chu being the critical vote to get Ed Lee in as interim mayor over Mike Hennessy, only to be backstabbed by his friend Ed, who smote Chu's own viability and plans to be mayor. It has classic B-movie plot written throughout.
We love that phrase, backstabbing in politics.
Smote. I like smote.
That's as good as it gets.
Here's another listener, Kurt, who writes, how do the candidates stand on Department of Building Inspections and Planning reform? Check out the reviews on Yelp, all negative except for two, where the reviewers were filing complaints against the landlord.
Well, you hear all the candidates say the same thing. We're going to cut through red tape. We're going to make sure there's not going to be favoritism. Really, the question is who's going to follow through on that? No, we've not had anyone, you know, they haven't had the chance yet to show how they're going to do that, except Ed Lee is mayor, and he's been mayor for a brief time. But you've got to say, is it better or worse in his brief tenure here? But that's a perennial issue in San Francisco. How are you going to make it a more fair and easier to navigate system?
Well, some wags are saying maybe people like this kind of calm administration as opposed to all the sparks that were flying around pyrotechnically under Newsom and under Brown.
I think that's absolutely true. And it seems like a lot of the candidates have promised to kind of keep in way the status quo of the Board of Supervisors and the mayor getting along. It wasn't just Gavin Newsom who was, again, the lightning rod in politics. But when he was in office, it was Chris Daley and Aaron Peskin were there. Aaron Peskin was turned out a couple of years ago or a year ago, I guess. And then Chris Daley this last year. And it is a different tenor at City Hall. Is it just Ed Lee? Is it just David Chu's running on that he's been able to bring the sides together? But even someone like John Avalos, who used to work for Chris Daley, has a very different temperament, a very different style. There are real no firebrands in there. Who are we going to go and knock heads?
And
it's Corey Cook.
And to get back to the original, the first email that you read, I mean, David Chu and Dennis Ware and others were running as the logical replacement to the acting mayor, that they would actually continue this new tone at City Hall. The early campaign before Ed Lee got in the race was actually David Chu saying, I'm, as a president of the Board of Supervisors, I'm equally responsible for this new tone. And so, I'll be just like the acting mayor is. And Dennis Ferreira saying, I've worked with everybody across the political spectrum. And so you sort of had this argument of I'm actually the perfect successor to Ed Lee. And then, lo and behold, Ed Lee gets in the race and changes everything.
Let's go to our callers. And Alan, you're first up. Join us. Hi, you're on.
Yes, good morning. I have a question about how the ranked choice voting works. And if you were to choose, if you were to put in as your second and third choice, your first choice, is that a way to game the system? Do you play it that way? Or if you really feel that you only support one candidate, does that work?
Corey Cook.
In essence, in ranked choice voting, your best strategy is to fully articulate all of your preferences. So if you only prefer one candidate, you should just vote for one candidate. But if you have real second and third choices, you should list them. The way the balloting works is the lowest vote getters are eliminated from the competition. And so
vote for your first candidate 1, 2, and 3 or just first candidate first exclusively?
Vote for your first candidate in your first choice column, vote for your second choice in your second column, and your third choice in your third column. Actually, bullet voting, where you just vote for one candidate either just once and leave the other two blank, or voting for the same person in all three columns counts the same in San Francisco. It's the same phenomenon. The challenge with that for a voter is, as soon as your candidate's eliminated from the competition, your vote then goes into a discontinued pile. So it's not to your benefit to actually only vote for one candidate. The only time your vote will actually go to your second choice is when your first choice is eliminated. So you mentioned earlier about some of these candidates, Phil Ting or Bevin Dufty or others who are saying vote for me second or third. The challenge is, will they actually even be in the competition when the second and third place votes of other candidates are counted? So if you list Ed Lee first and say, I like Bevin Dufty second, it's likely that your vote will stay with Ed Lee until the final round of the tabulation. It will never then be exchanged to another candidate. So for voters, your best strategy in ranked choice voting is to fully articulate your preferences. If you only vote like one, vote for one. But if you like more than one, it doesn't benefit your choices to not fully fill out your ballot.
I thank the caller. It's unlikely, though, here, Rachel, that we could see something like Oakland or San Leandro, for that matter.
I'm going to toss this over to Corey because he's been studying this as the academic here. But it as he said, it's not the anyone but Don Parada thing. So we likely will not see that phenomenon. But we haven't had this test in San Francisco. So I think all of us are hoping that there might be some surprises.
I know. As somebody who studies this, I'm praying for surprises because it keeps me employed. But certainly in terms of the Oakland race, there was a lot that was extraordinarily unique about Oakland. In San Francisco, most people don't fully fill out their ballot. They only list one choice. In Oakland, 80% of voters had all three choices filled out. That's very unusual. Don Prado was on first place with 33% of the ballots. He was in first. But he only appeared on 54% of the ballots total. So he was left off a huge number of ballots. I mean, of all the people who voted, 122,000 voters in Oakland, and just over half of them had him on the ballot at all. Jean Kwan was on 63% of the ballots. So, I mean, she defeated him. She was the preferred choice among people who went to the polls. But what was the disparity you saw was that Don Prado was so uniquely polarizing in that race that he was a lot of people's first choice and just not their second or third. And I have a difficulty believing that this will play out this way in San Francisco.
We'll go to more callers. Mike, join us. You're on. Good morning.
Hi, Michael. Hi, Corey. Hey, everybody. I have a question. It's another perennial and I think inflammatory issue that's coming up over the years. influence both mayoral choices and supervisorial choices in San Francisco, which is the question of TIC's and condo conversion. I personally own a TIC. I've owned one for 10 years. Our building is 100% owner-occupied. I'm a teacher. My wife's a massage therapist. We're not developers and rich people. And this is a divisive issue, I think, that's been in the city.
Mike, you've got a phone problem here, but let's take up the question of TIC and condo conversions. Rachel Gordon.
Right. So that has been raised on the campaign trail with some of the candidates coming out with different support of it. Some folks say that if you've been in a TIC, that's where a group of people jointly own the property, all the units, or you're on the hook for each other's mortgages, that you should maybe get a leg up in the condo conversion process. It has been polarizing for a long time. It's really been an issue between the rights of property owners and the tenant rights in San Francisco. We have to remember this city has 2/3 of the folks who live here rent their apartments. It's almost the opposite of most of the rest of the country here. A couple of the candidates say that they'd like to see that streamlined to give more condo conversions, and more conservative candidates have done that. Let's see. I think Bevin Dufty has, Michaela Alioto-Pierre, Tony Hall. John Avalos on the other side has said, we don't want to really do more condo conversions. He's saying he wants more affordable housing built for low and middle income people, and that for folks who might be losing their houses through foreclosure, he wants to make sure that there could be some kind of government assistance, loan assistance to help people stay in their housing.
Let me thank the caller. A web comment says, you blew off the actual issues of the Central Subway. That is, millions are unfunded, that the city will be on the hook for, that it is physically separate and will require great distances in walking, and that Muni MTA already cannot afford to maintain its current fleet, that an entire new system will add more station staff, police patrols, track maintenance people to MTA's already busted budget. Compare millions to simply adding more buses, which are far more fixed in cost and just plain cheaper.
Right. There are arguments, strong arguments on both sides of the issue. One of the issues is that the federal government is moving closer towards funding nearly $1 billion of this project. David Chu has been one of the most forceful people on the campaign trail about this, saying that is it really going to be in the city's best interest to turn down the opportunity to have a new subway in San Francisco? That the Municipal Transportation Agency, the Transportation Authority, the Board of Supervisors are saying, let's not neglect the opportunity to bring new transportation options into one of the most dense neighborhoods west of the Mississippi. That's into Chinatown. Yes, you can bring more buses in there, but the streets are already clogged. This gives people a different option.
And we bring Don on. Don, you're on.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I agree with the people, the guests, about how hard it is to differentiate the candidates, but I've really found that Bevin Dufty is committed to community dialogue in a way that none of the other candidates really are. And so I feel I'm supporting him in part because he's a dad who has a kid in the public school system, but especially because he is sort of the nice guy. But in addition to that, the reason he's the nice guy is because he's so committed to bringing different people to the table and to coalition work and to community conversation. And so that's really why I think he's the right candidate.
All right. We thank you for that endorsement. Actually, here's a listener, Jeremy, who writes on the web, John Avalos has the best chance of beating Ed Lee. There are 9 or more candidates competing for the moderate to conservative voters who supported Gavin Newsom. Avalos is clearly the progressive standard bearer and is the natural choice for the 40% or so San Francisco voters who identify as progressive and supported Matt Gonzalez. Okay.
Potentially, sure.
Well, here's another listener, Darlene, who writes, better education to take one issue is important, but the money's not there. The question becomes, how do you raise revenue? I want to hear the candidates discuss their strategies and what values of theirs are reflected in their strategies. Are we talking about raising more money and getting more capital, or do we have any lines of differentiation?
A lot of candidates are talking about that. Leland Yee, John Avalos, I think some others have talked about a personal or local income tax, which you'd have to get state approval for that. A number of them are talking about supporting parcel taxes for the schools and the parks. David Chu and others are talking about revising the business tax, which right now is on payroll, and they say that's a jobs killer. Others are going the other direction, saying that you should have tax breaks for companies to bring in more business here, and that will eventually raise revenue. Michaela Alioto-Pierre has been very strong on that with the biotech tax credit, as well as for the film industry tax credit.
What about Ed Lee's giving Twitter a pass and all that. I mean, that hasn't really been aroused as much of a major issue in this campaign, has it?
Yeah, it's interesting. And again, I think, you know, to me, this is a lot of the candidates disagreed with that and have said, you know, at the Big Guardian Forum and others, that they did, that the problem is the payroll tax entirely. And so they say, you know, you don't make deals with individual companies or even with individual communities. So I oppose it, but it's because we need to repeal the entire payroll tax. Others have said I favored it in this situation, but generally I oppose it. And as a result, it's become an issue. But again, I think for voters, you know, I enjoyed the Big Guardian Forum quite a bit that they held. I thought, you know, they got candidates as much as possible to really nail down on issues. And at the end of that, you sort of look at the field and, some of them like the vehicle license fee tax that Mark Leno is carrying through the state that would allow local jurisdictions to add on to the vehicle license fee.
Which the governor just vetoed.
Exactly. Yeah. So they're, but they're different shades of, they all sort of came up with a budget that came up with $300 million in new revenue. But it was, you know, slight variations of each other versions. And I think the point that Rachel made earlier, I think, is a key one, which is, and I think the callers are reflecting this, it's, you know, this race comes across a lot like more like, you know, the New Hampshire primary race, where voters are saying, I haven't decided yet. I've only met each of the candidates once. You know, let me meet all of them. Let me sit down with them. Let me see them. And then, you know, I'll really get a sense of who they are and vote for them based on that. But the issues don't seem to be differentiating as much as, you know, the comment about, you know, here's the person who's really representative of the community, or here's the person, you know, who'd be the most transparent, or here's the person who's the most refreshing or who'll most shake up City Hall. What I think, you know, the sense that voters get from the candidates is probably more significant than, you know, one of them says, I don't like the Twitter tax break, but I like the payroll tax repeal. And others say, I don't like the Twitter tax break, but I would have voted for it anyway. And, you know, it's...
I had put out the question earlier to listeners, what are you looking for? What's a major issue for you and what area of the city are you living in? Here's a Samuel, who's a resident living near Upper Haight. He says, I want to know, what do the potential mayors think of this recent SF Sit Lie law? And then he quotes a local comedian by the name of Nate Green, who says, it's a fact that 100% of crimes are committed by people not lying down. My take is that this law seems like a Band-Aid for a larger problem and just criminalizes homelessness.
Yeah, I think it was interesting to look at Bevin Duftie's stance on this, because Bevin was very big with Gavin Newsom on things like care not cash, aggressive panhandling, different ways to attack this. And you would have expected, I would have expected Duftie to go yes on the sit lie. But I think across the board, people are pretty much agreeing that this is a law. It's maybe nice for the police to have this tool in the books, but we're seeing that it's really not being enforced. It's not the best way to tackle the problem. But folks are just so fed up with the chronic panhandling, particularly on Haight Street, that they were looking for something. And Gavin Newsom was also looking for a wedge issue, and this was one of the latest ones he had.
Well, since you mentioned Bevin Duftie and wedge issues, another resident of San Francisco writes, I believe it's shameful that the African-American population in San Francisco is one of the lowest of any major city in the United States. I want to see the next mayor of San Francisco address the underlying issues that are driving minorities out of the city. And Duftie has made a big centerpiece of his campaign the importance of African-American community.
He has, and I shamelessly plug, we're having an event at USF next week on the state of Black San Francisco that Malia Cohen, member of the Board of Supervisors, and other prominent African-Americans in San Francisco, some academics and other people are going to come talk about, because the candidates really aren't talking about this very much. I mean, the census reveals that, you know, 6% of the city's population is African-American. The estimates are that maybe 3% of the electorate will be African-American in this election. So as a result, I think, you know, it's not been an issue. The you know, blackout migration has largely been off the agenda for the campaign, and Bevin Duftie has taken that up. And
he likes to mention that Billie Holiday was his godmother.
He does. I think
all the time.
I think that comes up in every forum. Yeah.
Well, we'll bring up some more of your calls. Steve, hi, you're on.
Yes, hi there. Thank you. I just wanted to revisit the question about the Central Subway, Chinatown. Is that the idea that $1.6 billion makes sense to put this tunnel in doesn't make any sense. If you just took Grant Street, for example, closed it off to bus traffic, and had a bus running back and forth completely dedicated, it would probably cost a couple $1 million a year to operate, and you could have $1 billion to use for other projects that are more effective in increasing our transportation system within San Francisco if this $1 billion was available. It doesn't make sense. It's still $1 billion of taxpayer money that shouldn't necessarily go to a subway system that might not be used as much as it's planned. You can just look at the BART extension to the airport and how many billions of dollars were spent on that system that is just not being used no matter how the planners were thinking about it.
Yeah, Rachel Gordon.
So there's taxpayer money and there's taxpayer money. The federal government's taxpayer money on this, and nearly $1 billion, is not going to come to San Francisco if it's not used for the Central Subway. It's not an automatic. It's not here, San Francisco. You can use this money for whatever way you see fit. This is a project. I don't want to be a booster. I can see arguments on both sides of it, but this was a project that's been in the work for more than a decade. It's gone through several layers of approval processes in the federal government already. If San Francisco has an idea to do something like have a bus-only street in Chinatown, they'd have to go back to the federal government, start from the beginning with the New Starts funding, and that could happen, but it's not like this money's going to fall back to us. Closing off Grant Street to everything but buses, good luck getting that through with the merchants there. It's possible to do it, but they have trouble even having transit-only lanes, one lane for buses on Mission or Market Street without people crying foul.
Oh, here's a listener, and I thank the caller, Kristen, who says, why is it so hard to get such projects as Cathedral Hill Hospital to the Board of Supervisors? There seems to be so many contingents attached to passing such a project mandated by the state, that is, earthquake standards of hospitals. I understand the developer must provide millions in benefits for the city that are not directly related to the hospital itself, construction, medical fields. I'm off the tangent now, but what influence would the new mayor have on such a project being approved by the city of San Francisco?
Well, the new mayor would have it'll be the mayor and the Board of Supervisors. The mayor has the bureaucracy to make sure that all the permits can go through, to make sure the transit changes can be done and there are any transportation improvements that would need to be done. But San Francisco has used for a long time the legislative process to make businesses do things. If you want to build here, this is what you have to do. Some of the big ones were with the Rincon Towers in Chris Daley's district, where he got, what was it, $50 or $60 million in concessions, payouts by the developer there. If you want to build here, you've got to give $50 million for community benefits. We saw that even with the Twitter tax break, that if you want to come in here, you have to be committed to hiring people from the community. With the hospital, with the CPMC thing on Cathedral Hill, their project, they're looking to make sure that they're going to be favorable to some of the unions that are going to be at the hospital. That's one issue. And it's really labor's tied into that and some of the development to see if people are going to be displaced. So San Francisco has a long, proud history, they'd say, of making sure that they could use a legislative lever to get things that they want that's beyond just the project itself.
Again, Rachel Gordon, the City Hall reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle. And Richard, you're our next caller. Jenny is our next caller. Excuse me. Jenny, you're on.
Hi. I'm calling about San Francisco Public Schools, and I'd like to hear comment about the disaster that they are. I'm a new parent, and my husband and I will be leaving the city, or we will be homeschooling our child when he's of school age. Thank you.
Well, we can talk about the public schools. The school board has been trying hard to bring in more parental involvement and choice, at least, in where their kids are going to go to school. But it is one of the biggest problems that people aren't happy with.
It's also one of the biggest reasons behind flight from San Francisco.
It absolutely is. As a parent who lost twice in the lottery process and now has my child in a private school, I see the frustration there. One thing we are seeing, though, is that there are more and more parents in San Francisco who are taking back their public schools that may not have been performing well, and they put in a lot of elbow grease and a lot of lobbying to make turn those schools around. And we see it in neighborhoods across the city, from Potrero Hill to the Sunny Side to west of Twin Peaks and even Presidio and Pacific Heights, where schools might have been not up to snuff and people are going, enough is enough. We're going to make these good schools now. And we're also seeing really cool things going on in the public schools with a lot of the bilingual programs, whether it's Mandarin immersion, Spanish immersion. There's a lot of good still to be said for the schools. So I just tell this caller, don't give up yet. Fight for your schools and see if you can get into a school you want to get into.
Corey, you want to add something?
Well, I have young kids, and my family's trying to move into the city, so we're hoping maybe we can work out a deal with the caller when she moves out. But I think one thing's interesting. We just did a survey in the early summer, and one of the questions we asked about the quality of schools, and there's a really sizable disparity, enormous disparity, actually, in San Francisco compared to the surrounding counties with your assessments of schools, depending on whether your kids actually were in the schools or not. And so people with, parents with kids in the schools think they're doing a pretty good job. It's the people who don't have their kids in schools in San Francisco who say they're entirely wrecked. And you see that difference in other counties, but it's a huge disparity in San Francisco.
Richard, join us. You're on the air. Good morning.
Yeah, I just have two quick questions for your guests there. Who among the candidates is or has a strong or used to have or has strong ties to Aaron Peskin, our local Stalin, and what kind of influence is he going to have over over these candidates? Because I seem to remember Herrera and Avalos both had strong ties to him. And the other thing is about the subway. Should we really spend $1 billion on a subway when it doesn't even connect to the other subways?
I told you this was a polarizing issue, the Central Subway. I mean,
never heard Peskin compared to Stalin. That's a first. Yeah.
Corey?
who has had or does have ties to Peskin? I mean, you know, David Chu had ties to Peskin. He was endorsed by Aaron Peskin. But then ultimately they split over the Ed Lee. They split probably before that, but when Ed Lee was named interim mayor, I think, you know, all the candidates to some extent have had, you know, have certainly had some relationships with Peskin. I mean, Herrera was endorsed by Aaron Peskin for mayor. You know, John Avalos was certainly was one of the progressive voting bloc on the Board of Supervisors. So, you know, I think.
Yeah, if you look at
their ties, but you know, I think what kind of sway will Aaron Peskin have on the next mayor? I think that's a little bit of a stretch.
Right. When we look at the Democratic Central Committee, which Aaron Peskin is the chair of, the two candidates they endorsed was John Avalos number one, Dennis Herrera number two. So that could say that's who. When you ask Aaron who he's for, that's who they endorsed. He still does have a lot of influence at City Hall. He does a lot of behind the scene things. I think it's not going to, you know, doesn't
very
make
involved
a difference.
In Treasure Island, for example.
Yeah, a lot of the development issues, CPMC, we're probably going to see. He's especially on development. He and his wife are very involved in the direction of San Francisco.
I'm going to read a few emails here. Is a listener who says, my choice is Jeff Adachi. I'd like to see the future major. Mayor, address the issue of rental control. Rental control procedures should take into account the income level of the tenant. Oftentimes in San Francisco, tenants have higher incomes than their landlords, but they're still entitled to rent control perks. Another listener, Paul, on the web writes, Mayor Lee believes that engaging and communicating with residents and business owners of our many diverse communities strengthens San Francisco neighborhoods and helps improve the quality of life for everyone. He's done a stellar job in his 22 years in public service. He has blossomed as interim mayor, and his decision to run was based upon the citizens of San Francisco praising the many accomplishments since being mayor. Another listener writes, as a resident for 20 years in San Francisco, I've witnessed a slow decline and decay of the city streets. Our city's apathy and lack of civic pride, our city's tolerance of filth and grime, not crime, all over the city. Driving home from the airport with tourists in the car, I am truly embarrassed to drive through Soma, across Market, onto Larkin to get to my home on Nob Hill. Unbelievable. I grew up in Chicago, a crime-ridden city 40 years ago. Dirty, gangs controlling the streets, abandoned buildings, empty lots with glass bottles. Now the city sparkles. You can eat off the streets. Where is San Francisco's pride? We need Rahm Emanuel. No. That's
yeah, another candidate. That's what we need.
Well, thank you both for helping us sort all this out and understand ranked choice voting to a much greater degree. Appreciate Julia McAvoy being with us, our senior editor, and Rachel Gordon, again, a City Hall reporter for The Chronicle. Corey Cook is with Public Service and the Common Good, University of San Francisco. We're with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. Next hour, we're going to talk about all this burgeoning literary activity in San Francisco, Litquake and Porchlight and Pop-Up Magazine. All when we return, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.